side of the moon. And it seems like it goes on like this forever. You must forgive me.
And good afternoon. It is about 20 seconds after 4 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first hour, you will hear the next in a series of not yet aired events from 2024's Kingston Writers Fest Festival. And today, in the first hour, I will feature, waiting for a countdown here on something. I need to stop. There we go. I'll feature writers Ashley Elizabeth Best, Farzana Doctor, might be Doctor, and Misty Pratt from a September 28th event called Making Care Better, Taking Better Care. This conversation runs just a minute or maybe not even over an hour, but it will air uninterrupted just a few minutes then into the second hour. And in the second hour, following the conclusion of that Kingston Writers Fest event, you'll hear an interview I did with Patrick or Pat Connors about his 2024 collection of poetry called The Long Defeat. I'll have a bit of time after that to let you know about a few calls for submissions, upcoming events, and I'll even have a little bit of time to, I'm going to play a couple of songs this afternoon in that second part of that second hour. First, though, I'd just like to share that my heartfelt thanks again. We did meet our goal for those who supported our funding drive in November and December. And I'm just for sure I want to give my thanks to all of those who supported the funding drive this year. It was really nice to reach our goal. That was really nice. I will say, though, that with the change in a federal ruling that allows a person to still make charitable donations and claim a tax receipt for 2024 up until February 28th, we are keeping the funding drive open. So if you'd like to get a charitable tax receipt deduction and get that sent to you, you have that opportunity until February 28th. I might mention that from time to time. I don't know that I'll do it every week, but I just thought I'd throw that out there. And I'll start with my usual start of the hour announcement. It is occasionally that some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language. But all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And a second announcement is actually the end of the hour announcement, but because we're going to run through the end of the hour, I just want to remind you now that both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for the show at Finding a Voice on CFRCFM.wordpress.com will remain there for 3 years, and those are definitely you. If you click on the blog space, you will see that each hour is a small, short paragraph of what you'll hear in that hour. So it's not like you're just looking at a bunch of numbers. So just thought I'd let you know in case you're interested, but both this hour today and the one coming up next will just like always be uploaded to that blog space when I get home, usually about 7 o'clock. So I tell you what, that's enough of this blathering around. Here we go again from 2024's Kingston Writers Fest. You'll hear writers Ashley Elizabeth Best, Farzana Doctor, and Misty Pratt This, again, from a September 28th, 2024 event called Making Care Better, Taking Better Care. Conversation, again, runs just over an hour and will run uninterrupted into the second hour. Here we go.
Good morning. We're going to get started. I did have an announcement to make in case you hadn't heard or didn't get the Know Before You Go email. Lisa Moore's event has been canceled for today due to a family emergency. There is not a replacement event for that. So you have a nice little break in your day if you'd like to go grab lunch somewhere during that event, or just visit some of the amazing sponsors that you saw on our sponsorship reel when you came in, trying to encourage folks to support those businesses who support the festival, because they're helping keeping Writers Fest going. So, my name is Tricia Knowles. I'm the marketing director and director of event sponsorship for Kingston Writers Fest, and I am very pleased to present Making Care Better, Taking Better Care. Before we get into introducing our moderator and our authors for this panel, I would like to take a quick moment just to acknowledge that we are gathering today on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Huron-Wendat, and the Haudenosaunee. Myself, as a Mi'kmaq settler, am incredibly privileged to be an invited guest on these lands, and so humbled to have the opportunity to invite you to gather with me in space and just take a collective breath together. I would encourage you to place both of your feet on the ground and just feel held by Mother Earth for a moment. Close your eyes if that feels right for you to do, and think about how the land holds us, feeds us, houses us, supports us, and then what we can do in turn to give back to her as we move forward on a path of truth and reconciliation. Monday is Truth and Reconciliation Day, and I had mentioned this just in the event previous to this. Tanya Talega, last night had said, a gentleman asked a question like, what's one thing I can do as an ally? And she said, read the 94 calls to action. Read them. They're short. They're just a couple sentences each. Read them and then find one, just one, that you can take with you and apply in your life. And if everybody did that, maybe we'll make a difference. So I'll leave that with you to contemplate. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We could all just take one breath together. I think I do that for me just as much as anything else. Gives me a second to pause. So again, thank you so much to the sponsors that were on the video. We do want to especially thank the Canada Council, Canadian Heritage, Ontario Arts Council, Experience Ontario, the City of Kingston, and Kingston Arts Council for their ongoing support of the festival. You may notice this year, if you're familiar with Kingston Writers Fest, we have QR codes about, and we have a little tip-tap machine for you to make a donation if it is in your means to do so and give a little extra to the festival this year. We're trying to raise money so that we can ensure that the festival will come back next year. So we do support any additional donations that you're able to give, and there are other ways you can support through the website at kingstonwritersfest.ca. A big thanks to Your TV, Profile Kingston, and CFRC, our media sponsors of the festival. They get the word out for us, and we are so incredibly grateful for them. I'd also like to thank Steve Page in memory of Joanne Page, author patron of Ashley Elizabeth Best, Sharon Hamilton, author patron of Farzana. Farzana, did I say it right? Oh, good. Farzana, doctor. Didn't have your pronunciation goal. And finally, and this is saving the best for last, I would love us to just, I mean, we do the round of applause, but can I like get some heartfelt thanks for the volunteers that make this festival come together, please? I know we went through that thing a couple of years ago, and people just haven't come back in the same numbers. And the people who are showing up here and volunteering for 5 days straight are just the most remarkable humans. So really grateful for the volunteers at the festival. Quick housekeeping notes. I'm going to give away some books at the end, which is really fun. So if you bought a ticket, you're in a draw. And please turn off your devices, anything that beeps or blips, mostly phones, but you could have something else in your bag. We have comment cards. Hopefully you got one when you came in. Fill that out. It's a chance to win a festival pass for next year's festival. And then there's a QR code. Take you to the homepage of our website. There should be a link on there for the long form survey. That's your chance to win every book in the Novel Idea window display. So it's win the window. You don't get to keep the typewriter, but you do get to keep every book that's in there. And almost every author that's at the festival this week has a book in that window. So a really incredible prize. And you can join our authors afterwards to get a copy of your book signed. They are for sale down in the lobby with Novel Idea. Now I am pleased to introduce Dr. Mike Condra. Dr. Mike Condra is an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Queen's. He has taught in the undergraduate and graduate programs in the Department of Psychology, Faculty of Education, and Faculty of Law. For more than two decades, Mike was the director of the Department of Health, Counseling, and Disability Services at Queen's University. He co-developed the Queen's University Crisis Intervention Institute and has presented at national and international conferences on the topics of mental health, risk assessment, stigma reduction, crisis intervention, and verbal de-escalation. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mike Condra.
Church, you can say good morning. Okay. Firstly, it's a pleasure to be back at the Writers' Festival. Not only is it fun, interesting people, interesting books, and today we have three very interesting books. But as I reflect on the Writers' Festival, one of the things that I've come to really feel at home with is hearing people exchange ideas and opinions and views on life without any of the rancor or bitterness that we hear in the media to, for example, our politicians. No name calling, no insults, no hurt feelings, just different ideas, and I love that. That's a very enjoyable part of this experience. I've done these before, but this morning is going to be, even for me, a little bit unusual because we have three books, three authors. The theme that holds them together has to do with mental health, caring for our mental health, understanding mental health, and particularly the experience of mental health for women and their relationship with the healthcare system. This is a challenging area. It's an area that has grown in interest greatly over the last few years, and the three books that we're discussing today shed wonderful, to me, wonderful light on many different aspects of this these problems. So what I'm going to do is this. Because there are three authors and three books, I'm going to introduce each author, have them come up on stage, and then introduce the second and the third so that you know what's what. First is Prasanna Doctor, whose work is called 52 Weeks to a Sweeter Life, a workbook for caregivers, activists, and the helping professions. This is a workbook of tremendous breadth. It deals with the kind of issues that caregivers, healthcare providers, and activists deal with in the course of their work, which result in all manner of stress, burnout, etc. It deals with how to self-nurture, take care of ourselves, and has a very interesting element to it in that it deals also with community self-care. Prasanna is a social worker, activist, and educator located in Toronto. Prasanna. Anywhere you wish. Ashley Elizabeth Best's book is called Bad Weather Mammals. This is a book of poetry which describes the challenges, tribulations, and very, very occasional joys of growing up with a disability and experiencing trauma. It also deals with the realities, sometimes quite grim, of interacting with a social service bureaucracy whose processes sometimes transcend human understanding. Ashley Elizabeth is a poet and essayist living in Kingston. Ashley. Our third author is Misty Pratt. Her book is titled All in Her Head: How Gender Bias Harms Women's Mental Health. This is a careful and detailed examination of the history of our current understanding and our historical views on mental health in women. It considers the intersecting roles of gender bias, historical characterization of women and their health problems, and includes a lovely analysis of social, structural, and economic factors such as gendered expectations, emotional labor, also known as mental load, and an economic model that we live in, which emphasizes individualism and productivity. Misty is a medical and healthcare researcher who has written for a variety of health-related magazines and publications, and she lives in Ottawa. Misty. We're going to be dealing with three authors and three books. I'm going to discuss each book with each author one-on-one, and if there's time, go back and forth with a few other questions. And because I tend to be a little conscious of the time and having to talk to three people, you'll see me occasionally, not out of lack of interest, turn this way and tap my clock to make sure I have enough time left. So be patient with me. I'm going to start with yourself, Misty.
I'm in a good spot then.
Excellent. So, I'll start with a general question. Your writing emphasizes the multiple factors which can create or cause or lead to mental health problems. These include things like food insecurity, as I said, our economic system, which values hard work, productivity, etc., violence in intimate relationships. Although this pattern may be changing, these are not topics that are often highlighted when people write about and talk about the onset of mental health problems. Can you talk a little bit about why that might be the case and why it is that we have a pretty strong focus on things like brain chemistry, progress in amazing medications, but not so much about the lived experience, which you rightly point out can lead people to exhaustion and eventually a mental health problem. Could you talk a bit about that?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I think, if we go back in history, we can see why we separate the mental and the physical, and that's how it's been for hundreds of years. And I think people when they think of something like hysteria, which I spend a little bit of time talking about in the book, they tend to think, oh, it's in the past, that it happened back in the 1800s. But you can go much, much further than that, all the way back to the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians. And so my belief is that we have just carried this forward. I don't think we necessarily are done with it. I think we still believe that mental has to do with up here, the head. It's the brain chemistry now. Before it was the soul. Something was wrong with your soul, that you had, you know, maybe there was something evil in you that had to be exercised out. And then the body was very much then taken up by the medical system and studied, and, you know, scientific thought came along. And so I don't believe we've made as much progress as we like to think. So I think in the 70s, there was a movement to start to treat people as human beings, knowing that we come to the table with lived experience. But there's no evidence to support that we've actually started doing that. So people say, oh, yes, I treat someone with, you know, looking at their biology, their psychology, and their sociology, or their environment. But I don't think we actually do that. I think we still kind of say, if you're mentally ill, it is a brain problem, and you must be treated by therapy and medication, which therapy and medication, wonderful. I've done both, very helpful. But we need to know more, and we need to know, well, how do we address the other side? And there's a really wonderful movement right now called social prescribing. I don't know if anyone's heard of this, but this is where we are starting to integrate, thinking about what do we need socially to feel better. And family doctors are actually handing out prescriptions for things like food security. So getting food if you need food, getting other social services that you might need. If you're a lonely senior, perhaps, you know, going for an art class. And so we're getting there. But I think we need the philosophy to shift, and that's going to take time.
Thank you. Early on in the book, you talk about, you write about the notion of healing. And I'm going to quote a little bit of what you say. Not a cure, in quotes, but a deeper, very personal understanding of ourselves and the social and cultural factors that affect our health. I found that a very, very exciting way to characterize this, because it in part goes back to what we talked about just now, like the cure, the end. This is the end point. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was always told from the time I got quite sick in my teens and onward that I needed to do these things to fix myself, that this would make me better. And I think I realized at a certain point, after decades of not really feeling better, constantly sort of falling back into different relapses, that that those things weren't going to fix me, because I was not broken in the first place, that there was never anything wrong with me. And so I think when I finally understood that in a very, very deep way, like it was a very meaningful and deep thing for me that I still, to this day, have to remind myself every day that I'm not broken. In fact, I had to remind myself last night because I had an anaphylactic allergy, which is why I look like this. My face is very puffy, so I was in the hospital in Kingston last night. And so I had to remind myself, like, I'm not broken. You know, this is, my body is reacting in some way to something, and it's going to take some time. But for mental illness, I think I know there's no cure, and I know that I will continue to struggle, and I don't know what's ahead for me. You know, we don't know in life what's coming up, and I could go back. But I think there is something in me now that knows this truth of not being broken, and that truth is what carries me forward through the harder times.
Good. Thank you. I'm going to touch on one more thing before we move on. You mentioned the role of social media in amplifying, and I want to just emphasize it's in amplifying, not in creating, amplifying a culture of judgment. We become very judgy people. Mm-hmm. Judgment, fault-finding, shaming, and comparison, which we all know leads to stress. related to the Buddhist concept of it's actually jealousy or a yearning that creates our distress. I think about this from an individual point of view, so maybe I could just talk about that rather than the big picture. What can we do as individuals with regard to this kind of issue, amplifying, shaming, and judging?
Oh my gosh, I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I think I'll talk about personally what I have done.
Yes.
So I think for a while I probably got sucked into that too. When social media first came onto the scene, you know, there was suddenly this way for us to share our personal experiences and to feel validated, which was lovely. That's the good part of it. The bad part is that sometimes we get stuck in our lane, and social media is an easy way to then, you know, debate with other people, but perhaps we feel less restrained in that debate when we're online and we're, you know, people don't know who we are. I personally have had to put very strict rules in place for myself now with social media, that I've had to pull back from that because I think, you know, it interrupts my nervous system. I don't know about you, but like I get hyper kind of vigilant, and I know when it's not doing something for me. So now I've started to look to say, where is it? Because with mental illness, there is a community you can find. There's beautiful support you can find, but you have to look at the right spaces, and some of them, as we know, are not the best.
I'm wondering if I could just sneakily ask the other two of you if you want to jump in and address that as well. Maybe not.
Should I go? I have a chapter that looks at our online interactions, and it's a lot of what you've said and what Misty has said. But one of the things that's really important for me is to pay attention to my nervous system and let that be my guide. I'm not going to go on social media when I'm feeling dysregulated, I'm feeling hyper or hypo-aroused, if I'm just not feeling very grounded. The other thing I try to do, and this doesn't always happen, right? Nothing is perfect, but I try to make sure that I am pretty grounded before I engage with that. It's like if I'm going to walk into a room of people, I want to make sure I'm feeling pretty grounded, right? So it's the same thing if I'm going into social media, which is like a gazillion rooms of people. I need to make sure that I'm feeling fairly grounded before I interact.
Sure. Thank you.
I think just not engaging with social media is important when you're feeling dysregulated. It took me a long time to figure out what was manifesting with me that signaled that dysregulation. Once I figured that out, now I can be like, okay, I'm not okay right now. I need to step back. What can I do to look after myself? And as someone who I feel like I was the target of a lot of disbelief, people didn't believe a lot of what was happening with me for a lot of years, that I just try to remember that everyone has an individual experience, and that comparison on social media amplifies that shame sometimes, you know, and that we all have our own experiences, and we just have to, like, I just have to validate that by validating myself and just let them, you know, let them have their peace if they really want it and back away from it.
Good. So if I was to kind of pull those threads together, I would say self-awareness, that all three of you have referred to either feeling this nervous system arousal or emotional dysregulation, and making that be the source of your own agency, right? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move on. Ashley, Elizabeth, I am wondering, since your book is a book of poetry, if you might do us the honor of reading a poem.
Yes. I will read the one here. I don't know if everyone can hear me. Maybe. I'm short. There we go. Mike had suggested this one, so I will read this one here. A Day for Worries. Wednesday is a day for worries. How many plastic bags did you use this week? Is your medication out? Will rent be late this month? What will we do when we inherit the earth? stuck in remembering where nobody is ever missing. This Wednesday, it's 3 days since your mother told, my mother told me she has cancer, stuck at a gas station on my way to Sudbury. The bus rides each snow squall, and this Wednesday is no different from any other Wednesday on the bus. The woman in front of me with blue star tattoos on her face is traveling west 2 weeks after her boyfriend overdosed at an army base. Before I left, the man I thought I loved gave me gifts. Turtle dove hearts engraved on a box, a Contigo mug, a band shirt, and claimed half my front tooth with a fist. Love, after all, is not practical. It's a survival necessity. Today, I'm going to the mountains where I can mourn a life that was never mine, where what I can't write about you wakens me, where I can believe the mind is in the head and nobody is ever missing.
Thank you. I found that very vivid, very descriptive. I can see the fellow passenger with the tattoos. I like that. The other thing that I find so striking in that, and I want to explore that a bit with you, is the descriptive line for the violence becomes quite shocking and sudden, because it's embedded in these gifts, nice things. Yeah. And I'm interested in why it's characterized like this, and it relates to a number of things that are in the poems, where the violence in the context of what, you know, the man who says he loves me, for example, the person who says that they love me, is shocking. Okay, to just talk about that.
Yeah. So I guess it was intentionally shocking. So in my, you know, my early 20s, I had entered into a relationship around the same time that I became sick, and I had to have a surgery, and then another surgery because of internal bleeding, which I almost died of. And then after that was when, you know, a culmination of just a really traumatic and difficult childhood led to a bipolar diagnosis, eventually, because my mental health was already shredded at that point and it just completely fell apart. So I was in this relationship with someone who, it seemed fine at first, but I had to go on ODSP because disability, because I had to leave school because of all of these issues. And so I became trapped in a 9-year relationship, which was almost a direct result of ODSP, because, you know, if you don't know, you have to submit your partner's financial information. So your income is directly tied to your partner's income. You cannot be financially independent. So I stayed in a relationship for a very long time because of this poverty loop. And I think that's something, you know, people don't recognize about ODSP, how difficult it is to get on it, stay on it, and then how difficult it is to just be a financially independent person. And I think I've known a lot of people on disability who also have been trapped in abusive relationships. So yeah, it was meant to be shocking because, you know, the duration of a 9-year relationship, things can seem fine sometimes and then they're not. And when they're not fine, they're really not fine. So
just a comment. I think you captured that piece of it from my work experience. I'm familiar with it really well. It just kind of comes out of the blue because in the context of something that, nice gifts, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Your use of this is again a comment on where you might be able to talk about it. Your use of metaphors in a number of poems is quite, I think I wrote down the word, very clever word, mind-boggling, actually. It's mind-boggling. You talk about voices braided in the wind. You talk about hills of cloud spraying their back. And then this one that I love. Only magpies come from the dark stretch of your mouth. Those are wonderful. You want to talk just a bit about how you use metaphor?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure what I can say. The magpie metaphor was a dream I had about, you know, my first love who had passed away. So I was having these really intense dreams, and I think it's often induced by medication, the medications I'm on. But I kind of have to twist my mind into these metaphors, if that makes sense. I I'm trying to think of my approach. I learned in school, I started in French immersion, and so I learned to read and write in French, and then went to an English school, like a very low-income English school, and I completely lost it all. So I think sometimes the way I structure sentences is the way it would be structured in French, but it's in English, and so I think that contributes to sort of the way I play with language. And also, my mother was severely dyslexic, so growing up, I would, you know, write notes for her, help her fill out forms, and, you know, I got in trouble a lot at school because I would write a note, and then she would sign it, and the teachers would think that I forged the whole thing. So I learned very early on not to criticize other people for their use and understanding of language, and trying to understand everyone's coming from a different place. You know, it's a very elitist way of looking at the world to be constantly correcting someone's language use like that. And especially for my mother, she would just create these weird word combinations and make her own words up. And it was so normal to her, and it was so normal for me until I left home, and I didn't recognize that things she was saying were just not, like, it was something she had made up. I think that's where that comes from.
That's great. And for people in the audience, your description of what happened in those exchange of notes between you, the school, and the teacher, it's very well worth reading. I found that very moving. Actually, very moving. Okay, quick question. In Happy Onions, the name of the book, and you wanted to read it, but I just wanted to read something. You never asked me to write about something other than my own troubles, even when I should have. Your loss is a hollow where happy onions grow, waiting for your dispatch. Sounds like you're talking to someone. Who?
Yes, was a longtime resident in Kingston, Wayne Westfall. And he was in our writing group, the Villanelles, and I'm trying to remember the year of 2020, he went through with MAID. He was paraplegic. He was very ill. He was not just constantly sick. And we were able to say goodbye to him, and he gifted us all these paintings, and one of them was Happy Onions. And I always felt like I shouldn't complain. And Wayne never told me, you know, he said he wanted me to write my truth and write what I had to say about my own experiences. He was always so encouraging, and he said, never apologize for what you're writing. And he was just so wise, and yeah, I miss his company. So that's for Wayne, yeah.
I actually knew Wayne.
You did? Oh, okay.
And I know his unfortunate, tragic reason for being paraplegic. Terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a question I'm going to start with yourself, actually,
okay.
And then I'm going to very quickly go to the others. And if you don't mind, I'm going to, the poem is Stop Asking Why I Stayed, and it's about staying in a violent relationship. Mm-hmm. So first, a little personal anecdote about myself. When I started working as a clinician, I worked in a mental health unit, and there were a number of people, women in patients who had been in violent relationships, and often the question you'd hear asked was, why is she staying? Then much later on, there's an Irish movie called Herself, which is well worth watching. And in it, a woman who is in an abusive relationship, the movie is very uplifting, but she's in an abusive relationship, is in court, and the judge says to her, why did you stay? Why did you keep on staying? And she replies, Your Honor, why didn't you ask him? Why did you keep beating her?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right? So I'm wondering why are we here in 2024? And I don't want extended answers, but just give your thoughts, all three of you. I guess I'll start with yourself, actually, since this is your point.
I think I mentioned that I think the reason I had stayed was because I had no other means of survival. I didn't have familial support in the same way. I didn't have financial support. I was completely on my own. And I had younger siblings with children and, you know, mental health issues themselves that needed my support. And I really do believe ODSP was what kept me there. I didn't have any other means of leaving, saving money. Up until Trudeau took over, you were only allowed to have $7,000 in assets. So if you owned a car, that's your assets. If you had $7,000 in savings, that's your assets, and that was it. And it was changed. It's been up significantly now, which is, I don't understand how it was ever that low. So there's just no means to save money and get out.
My question is, why are we still digging this burrow again? Do you know what I mean? Okay. Because what you describe is a classic, and it's exactly why it is the way it is. But
I think there's just a fundamental misunderstanding of how our social systems actually work for the people living under it. And I think that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, most people I spoke to about it, their recommendations were absolutely ridiculous for getting out of it. Oh, well, you could just rent a room somewhere, you know, get rid of all your stuff and, you know, it's your apartment, it's in your lease. Their solutions for leaving were not realistic and would have thrown me into deeper poverty and disadvantage. The supports are not there, I think, is the real answer.
Yeah. Would either of the two of you just like to...
I would probably just say the patriarchy. I really do feel that because of the system of power is so big and it benefits so many people, not just men, it's so hard to change, right? Like, it trickles down into everything. And so I think that, you know, it's a really not a satisfying answer, because it's like, I can't, you know, give any tips for how we should change it. But I think... yeah, and that's what I struggled with in my book, was writing about solutions, because I just sometimes feel a little bit hopeless. So, okay. Not every day.
It's such a good question. I don't have anything to add, but it's such a good question. Why are we still here?
Yeah. I would like to add one or two other things. The concern for me is, why are especially professional people still working with that assumption and asking those questions? Because the trigger for me is when I don't understand something and it makes absolutely no sense, I have to work on me. Do you know what I mean? It's the problem isn't them, it's actually me. Clearly I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, that's by the by. Thank you very much, Ashley. I'm going to move on to Sana, to you. Could I start with a tongue-in-cheek question? Would that be okay?
Sure.
Just lighthearted.
Okay.
In your book, you assert that self-care is really less exciting than changing the world. Is that true?
Yeah, so where that comes from is that... So this isn't a tongue-in-cheek answer, though. It's going to be a serious answer. So in that section, I talk a lot about how people who grow up to be helping professionals, who are caregivers, who are activists, often come from family histories, from their personal histories, where they were the family mediators, they witnessed violence, they were the family interpreters, they were just children who were working way above their pay grade. And so it became this... This pattern of we light up in other people's crises, but when it comes to having calm within ourselves and low drama within ourselves, it can be less exciting.
Yes.
Now that's just a personal piece, right? I also talk about the structural issues.
Yes, you do. I just, yeah. As I say, somewhat tongue in cheek.
Yes.
Okay, so one thing about your book that I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I wanted to follow up and then talk a little bit about is, many workbooks end up with sections that give you tasks,
yes,
things to accomplish, things to do, and to work through that program. But you have constructed those as, you refer to them as experiments. I'm certain that was deliberate,
yes,
and I love it, but could you just talk a bit about why you call them experiments?
And they're all framed as optional.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So this is where it comes from, right? So I was trying to, this comes from my own experience of a couple of burnouts, but also I supervise younger social workers who can teach workshops about self-care. They know all the science behind it, and yet they have a lot of difficulty managing it themselves. So they say they have no time, they have no energy for any of this. So I thought, like, if I could compile something that is really, like, easy. Each chapter is like a 3-minute read, and then there are these little experiments, things to reflect upon and try, optional. And then there are these even more optional deeper dives if people want to read further, if they want to watch a video or they want to see more. So it's really designed to be like, how do we present this so that people don't feel like it's a burden? Yeah.
One other side of the experiment is that you have also actually characterized it as something which might or might not work.
Yes.
And when you characterize it in that way, it really takes some burden off people. A bit like, I'll use a parallel, having worked a lot with people who were very anxious and thinking of somebody who, you know, her partner wanted her to go to a theater, but she felt uncomfortable in crowded spaces. So part of the quote-unquote way to deal with that was, one, sit in a certain place, which she did, and the other was, you have permission to leave, you know? Yeah. You can leave. What's the worst thing that's going to happen, right? And that's what I see in the way you've characterized the experiment. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, you're going back to it without a sense of failure.
That's right, yeah. That's
fair.
Also, we know that, like, people are so unique, right?
Yeah.
So one of these little experiments might do nothing for somebody, and that's okay. Or it might be life-changing.
Good.
Yeah.
Your book also deals with, if you like, two sides or two aspects of self-care, which you call self-care, mm-hmm. You don't call it genuine self, but self-care as we would ordinarily understand, things I do to make myself feel better or help myself feel strong. And then community care.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I found that very, very interesting, very uplifting. I'm wondering if you just want to talk about why you thought it was important to include both of those elements.
There can often be this false dichotomy between self-care and community care, and in recent years, especially the more politicized folks have said, no, we need to be leaning more towards community care and not self-care, which has
yeah.
become very individualistic and consumeristic. But I think self-care is community care, and community care is self-care. I think it's all a bundle that works together. One, because if we are just focusing, let's say we're focusing on doing something that feels good, that will be contagious. If my body is calm, so we saw with the person who started us off today, and we took a couple of collective breaths, right? The room changed. It is this collective. We are always in a collective. My body relates to everybody else's body, and their bodies to my bodies. The other piece too is that this book is for folks who are fairly collectively minded, and so they are engaged in community care a lot, right? They're caregivers, they're helpers, they're activists. And I also wanted to talk to them about how is that self-care, and how do we monitor and pace ourselves? How do we tune in to understand what is our true capacity? So we're not doing too much,
right?
Because this is sacred work. This is beautiful work. It's joyful, but if we're not resourced enough, it can be a hardship.
Excellent. Okay. So I'm going to just touch on one more. Actually, I'll make it a double question, which is not that fair, but you'll have to live with this. Your book talks about the challenge that caregivers can experience in asking for help. But it also very wisely includes a section on the different ways people have of signaling that they need help, right? Which, again, as I say, I found it interesting. Not everyone walks up to you and says, hey, have you got 5 minutes? I need your help. So do you want to talk about, first of all, the difficulty that caregivers may have, and then the other part of recognizing that we don't all ask for help in the same way?
Yeah. It's something I hear so often. Often the people who are the most generous caregivers or helpers or activists are have difficulty asking other people for help when they're having trouble. And people can probably recognize it. They might be like, well, I might ask, but I might not get, or I might ask, and I'm going to just have to do it all myself anyway. That won't be right. I get into a little bit of conversation about how it's very likely our history from when we're quite young that probably asking for help was a troublesome thing from the get-go, and so it stays a troublesome thing. And then I also talk about how we need to teach people. We need to give people instructions because nobody knows how to help us, right? So we can't expect that someone's going to lean in unless we tell them exactly how to lean in.
Yeah. We have to be able to tell people what would help us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very specific ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're starting to wind down. We're going to have a 1 minute round, okay? I'm going to put each of the three of you a little bit on the spot and say, I would like you to tell the audience in about 1 minute, I won't time it, but about a minute, something that you would like them to take out of this room about your book. Something that would shine a little light for them or give them a feeling of warmth in their heart or something that may make them puzzle and remember, whatever. And it can be anything. It's over to you.
Me first?
Yeah, why don't you?
So I talk a lot about how burnout is structural. So there's no shame in it. We often talk about avoiding it, preventing it, but I think rather than that, we need to talk about recognizing it and attending to it when it's in its early stages, and it's something to be expected rather than something to be feeling ashamed about.
Could I add one other piece that I think is also, you were the first person I've seen write about burnout and emphasize that it, A, doesn't just come from the world of our professional work, that it can have, and B, that it's related to the issue of amount of responsibility, not necessarily the amount of work, but where responsibility implicitly lies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's a hard question. I think what I'd like people to take away, besides maybe some shock, is just to cultivate deep listening for people who are vulnerable and who are telling you they're about their lived experience, and to try to listen to them and understand the systemic issues that have led them to where they are and how you can voice those things in your day-to-day life, sort of like the task list, what or like that list that Tricia was talking about, like what can you take away from what someone's saying, what can you speak about on four of those vulnerable people, because we're burnt out. You know, it's been a lifetime of disability and trauma and caregiving for my younger siblings and their children, and we would like support, but I think that we need to lead with our lived experiences, but we still need help.
Okay. And yeah. Misty.
And I think just to address that too, is that every single person I interviewed for my book said that they wish somebody had listened to them. That was the number one thing when I asked, like, what do you want to change? Or what do you wish would have been different? Is that somebody had just sat and listened and not assumed or given advice or given a diagnosis without sort of hearing what was really going on. So, but I think my takeaway too for everyone is just, you know, I was very surprised to learn that our health is not about our individual behavior. So we used to think that everything we did made up our health, whether we ate well, exercised, all that stuff. We now know it's probably over 50% of our health is due to our social situation. And that's what makes up our health. And so it was such a surprising fact for me that I think that that's one thing I'd like to take away too.
Okay, thank you all very much. We are now at the point in the session where we turn it over to questions from the audience, and we have a couple of microphones, so if you have questions, now's your chance.
Hi, I like what was mentioned about kind of understanding self-care and community care together as one thing. And I think something that I have been reflecting on a lot with regards to the mental health system is that what I see is that a lot of people are working extremely hard to deal with the issues that were caused by politicians, and I don't see anybody really saying, no, this is unacceptable, you solve your problem. If taking time for self-care is stopping the care of others to address what resources you need so that you can keep doing this, so striking is illegal for mental health workers and organizing patients in acts of protest is illegal, but at what point would those acts be considered necessary self-care for a system that's in crisis? And do you see an appetite for civil disobedience in the mental health field as a response to these political crises?
Is that one for me?
We're all looking at
me. I'm glad we started with an easy question.
Wow.
Good question. Thank you.
Tricia Hersey has written this book called Rest is Resistance, right? And thinking about how political self-care really is. And, it's a tricky thing. If the clients are organizing themselves, great, right? There's a power imbalance. You can't have the providers organizing. But I think definitely, the providers should be able to strike, right? So much of... When I said, things are structural, one of the big issues has to do with worker rights, right? It's internalized capitalism, external capitalism. It's the way capitalism has completely controlled our lives and devalued human experience, overvalued money and work. Yeah.
I'll just add another author too, Devin Price. I don't know if anyone has read Devin's books, but yeah, it speaks to those issues so well, and I interviewed him for my book as well, and so he has a lot of great things to say about that. And I'll also add too that I think within, I work in healthcare research, and I see the people working in the system are just so passionate for change that, I'm sure there are the people who are burning out, but there are also the people who are like, just, I need to change this, and I'm going to do it myself in my own practice as much as I can. And so that also gives me a little bit of hope that we can then continue to poke at our governments to just, make a shift and make a change.
If it's okay, I'm going to add one other little piece, because I agree with what Misty and Farzana have said. I am utterly disappointed with the way our leaders have not led on this and a number of other issues. You ever hear of a problem called climate change, for example? And I think at an individual, personal level, there are some things that we can do, and you've talked about that, Misty. I also think that it's not a bad idea to make your voices heard in different ways. Like everybody else who's worked in any form of healthcare, I have awfully ambivalent feelings about striking. I totally accept it as a principle, and yes, and when railway workers or grain elevator workers, or I have difficulty. It's only because of my own ambivalence. I acknowledge the ambivalence. It wouldn't. I'm not sure how it would guide me. I'm retired now, so I don't have to think about that. But I'm not sure how it would guide me. You have another question?
Thank you. Thank you all for writing your books. They're amazing, and thank you for sharing. And I
compiling all of this information over time for myself and for the younger social workers I work with. And then, because I had written a bunch of books before, I kind of realized, I think this is a book. I think I have enough for a book. And I started also adding in my own personal anecdotes to make it a bit more pretty and craft. I was concerned about craft, and that's how that came about.
And I wanted to write about my grandmother, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in her mid-50s. And this was in the 80s, at a time when the mental health care system was not what it is today. It's not great today either, but it was a lot worse back then. And so she